Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3, the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Wait, it's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. Broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. That makes me sound real important, too.
You are important.
I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today on this Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Mark Dunley of the Green Education Legal Fund speaks about the Green New Deal. Then Livonia Mallory brings us part three of her conversation with Dorothy Kim, who teaches medieval literature at Brandeis University. After that, Peter Savio speaks with Eleanor Stein, adjunct professor at Albany Law School, providing an overview of the extent of recent policy and regulatory work around climate. Then Cassidy McCabe speaks with Mary Gavazzi, the president of the Troy Library Board, about grassroots organizations and individual active efforts in the community. Then to close out the show, Steve Pierce speaks with Taina Asili about her new album, Resilience.
But let's start the show off with some headlines, Guy.
Yeah.
49 people were killed in a shooting at two mosques in central Christchurch, New Zealand, on Friday, in a terrorist attack that appeared to have been carried out by a white nationalist supremacist who posted a racist manifesto out online and streamed live video of the attacks on Facebook. The manifesto that the New Zealand shooter published expressed similar sentiments to the ones written by Norwegian right-wing extremists who killed 77 people in 2011.
Students from across the capital region were skipping school on Friday to push for legislation addressing climate change as part of a worldwide strike that looks to push world leaders to acknowledge, prioritize, and properly address the climate crisis. The movement was started by a 16-year-old Swedish climate activist, Greta Thunberg. Thousands of students from around the world have joined in.
Cameras will be allowed in the courtroom during the trial and pretrial hearings for R. Kelly in his sexual abuse case. The RPI singer is accused and can't, but it, okay, it won't be filmed. Okay, for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Network, WOOC 105.3 FM and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
Up next, Mark Dunley of the Green Education and Legal Fund speaks about the Green New Deal at a forum at the Albany Public Library. This is the third of a three parts for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine with Mark Dunley, the correspondent.
This is Mark Dunley for WOOC. I was the third speaker at the Green New Deal Forum in the Albany Public Library on Saturday.
So the Green New Deal, just to be clear about it, is a number of different aspects. As Howie talked about it, initiating in Europe, one thing that doesn't get talked about as much here in the United States was since it was initiated in Europe in response to the global economic meltdown, the financial crisis, it had a lot more details about the need to reform the financial system. That doesn't tend to get as discussed much here in the United States. The two things that we have been focusing upon has been the need for quick, immediate action on climate change, to move to 100% clean energy by 2030, and by clean energy and 100%, we mean everything. And that's been one of the big differences between our proposal and what AOC has more recently initiated, in that she primarily has been talking about electricity, which is important, but that's only 25% of the carbon footprint. And in particular, for some reason, the AOC proposal at this point does not expressly call for immediate halt to fossil fuels. And while we've been pushing that in New York State, there's actually some legal questions about our authority to do so. In New York State, there is no question about our legal authority to do that at the federal level. but so we're a little bit mystified about that. I actually very much, of course, am very excited about what the Sunrise Movement and AOC has done, because despite our efforts since 2010, the reality is the Sunrise Movement and AOC has gotten 1,000 times more media coverage and has made this a real issue. And we would like it to be stronger, but she actually combines many of the most positive aspects of the Green New Deal from its initiation, trying to deal with climate change and an emergency mobilization on a very fast timeline, combined with the New Deal part of it, which was in FDR's last State of the Union, he talked about doing a second Bill of Rights, an economic Bill of Rights. And so that's universal health care, which we would define as single-payer health care. It's a guaranteed right to a living wage job. It is about access to affordable housing. It is about access to quality education, including free college education. Most of that is in what AOC is talking about, AOC and now, you know, Senator Markey. So that's very positive. There's certainly a lot of pushback, not only from the more conservative elements, but to be honest, a lot from people within the climate movement who don't understand why we need to combine quick action on climate with an economic Bill of Rights. They do get the part about we need a just transition and we need a commitment to environmental justice, but they've been less committed to some of the things like full employment and single-payer health care. But even the Pope gets that, is one of the things I tell him. You know, in the, you know, Labor encyclical, the Pope said the reasons, the mentality that allows humans to exploit the environment and which has driven climate change is the same mentality that allows the rich of the world and the rich of this country to exploit the poor, for men to exploit women, for powerful countries, military countries to exploit others. And even the Pope understood that in order to resolve climate change, we must resolve those other aspects of discrimination. And as Howie says, it's really critical that that the average American, that the average person feels that their life is going to be better through a Green New Deal. One thing I think we do talk more about with our Green New Deal is the concept of public ownership, that in fact we need to exert democratic control over our energy system. And that can be through worker ownership, it can be through municipal power. Cannot continue to allow the free market to determine our energy policy, because that is why we have, you know, climate, you know, chaos bent into us. One other point I would make is that the IPCC, which is one that we have 12 years left to take action to avoid catastrophic climate change, is a generally fairly conservative body. And so far, every report that they have put out on climate change has underestimated the severity of the problem, and they have underestimated how quickly it is occurring. And that is because of the process. Both the scientists are not generally, you know, trained to take bold statements, particularly across issues. They're taught to work on one particular aspect of an issue. And then even more challenging is whatever the IPCC puts out has to be approved by Saudi Arabia, by the United States, by Russia, and by Brazil. And in the most recent IPCC report, Saudi Arabia in particular was quite difficult. And with that 12 years that they're talking about we have left to act, the IPCC actually says we're going to go way, way past the tipping point if we keep to trying to, say, reduce average greenhouse gas emissions by 9% a year, and they rely upon a miracle solution that they hope that will figure out a way for technology to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. I hope so too, but we've spent $30, $40 billion so far in research and have not come up with anything. And to, you know, basically base the fate of life on this planet on developing a miracle technology, I do not think is a very reasonable position for the IPCC to take. So when they say 12 years, we think it needs to be done much faster. One of the interesting things in New York State with the resolution on the Green New Deal that Alexandria and Mark have introduced, there are now 13 Congress members just from New York State who have signed on to that resolution. 13, and Senator Gillibrand. Now, does anybody want to guess a couple local guys who haven't signed on to this bill? Taco hasn't signed on to anything, and Delgado has not yet signed on to it. So we here in the Capital District, I mean, even Brian Higgins has signed on to this thing. Last year, Congressman Taco was the only Democrat in the New York State delegation that refused to sign on to the OFF Act, which is a proposal to move to 100% clean electricity by 2035 and on transportation. So we have our work cut out here in the Capital District. There is now a Green New Deal proposal in the New York State Legislature. The lead sponsor is Senator, I keep on saying Senator Sanders. People say, what is Bernie doing with the Green New Deal in New York? I said, no, it's Senator James Sanders, who's from Queens, and then Assemblymember Felix Ortiz. But it is good that at least we're getting some movement on this as well. Now, of course, Governor Cuomo has said that he is now wants a Green New Deal for New York. And I think one of the things that has occurred is that a lot of elected officials are now using Green New Deal as basically to make the point, which is a valid point, that if we invest in renewable energy, we will create jobs. And so that the transition to a cleaner future is a job creation program. Well, that's a good point, but that's not what the Green New Deal is. Also, the reality, any good proposal that relates to the climate change, that's not the Green New Deal. And increasingly, groups will say, well, I'm doing something good on the climate, so that's the Green New Deal. No, the Green New Deal is a more comprehensive thing, and it combines very fast action on climate change, and it also includes the concept of the economic bill of rights. How to pay for it? This is one of the other issues we disagree with AOC, and unfortunately for much of Congress, in that I was reading yesterday a news article that told us how much the Green New Deal would say, and I said, this is great. Finally, somebody did it. And then I realized they were actually took my information from a couple of years ago and didn't credit me for it. But I estimate it was about $1 trillion a year, $400 billion for the public jobs aspect of it, $200 to $300 billion a year for the climate change aspect of it. But it's just, a serious amount of money. One of the things that we call for, and I know Code Pink's been quite pushing on this, is that we need to cut the military budget. And we could free up $300 to $500 billion a year that could be invested in it. We need a carbon tax, as some of the other speakers have mentioned. And we certainly need, and part of the thing about a carbon tax is really trying to hold the corporations that have been destroying life on our planet knowingly burning fossil fuels when they knew the damage that it's caused. Exxon and Chevron have known this for 30 years. They should pay for it. And then finally, fist bump time, we got to sort of tax the rich.
The rich. That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley of the Green Education Legal Fund speaking at the Green New Deal at a forum at the Albany Public Library.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Next up, Livonia Mallory has part three of her conversation with Dorothy Kim. Dr. Kim teaches medieval literature at Brandeis University and also has two books, The Alt Medieval, Digital Whiteness and Medieval Studies, and Decolonize the Middle Ages, forthcoming with ARC Press. She talks about the alt-right and its whitening of medieval periods.
Once again, we have another exciting segment of Reclaiming History right here at 105.3 FM, the sanctuary for independent media. I'm Livonia Mallory. Today, we have a very special guest. Dorothy Kim teaches medieval literature at Brandeis University. Her research focuses on race, gender, the digital humanities, medieval women's literature, culture, medievalism, Jewish and Christian differences, books of history, digital media, and the alt-right. She was the 2013 2014 fellow at the University of Michigan Frankel Institute of Advanced Judaic Studies, where she drafted a monograph entitled Jewish Christian Entanglements, Anchoring Wise and Its Material Worlds, which is forthcoming from the University of Toronto Press. She also has two books, The Alt-Medieval Digital Whiteness and Medieval Studies, and Decolonize the Middle Ages, forthcoming from ARC Press. She is co-editing A Cultural History of Race in the Renaissance and Early Modern Age from 1350 to 1550 with Kimberly Coles, University of Maryland, College Park. Also is editing a special issue of Medieval Feminism Forum, a journal of gender and sexuality on medieval trans feminism. Dorothy Kim, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History.
Thank you for having me, and I'm delighted to be on.
And you wrote in the encyclopedia about race?
Yes. So I was asked by Ruth Mazzocaras, who's a medieval historian, to write the entry for race in the new Encyclopedia of the Middle Ages. And in the process of trying to figure out, like, how do I frame what's going on with this term, it really became an exercise in me sort of working out why this term has become such a pushback issue amongst particularly my medieval historian colleagues, and why they continue to say that I should be using the term ethnicity. And that really is about medieval history as a field ignoring basically 50 years of historical methodology and 50 years of research about the historiography of their field.
Wow.
It'll be an interesting conference discussion at some point. That'll be very interesting in so many ways. And, you know, to be very straightforward and honest about it, yes, what I'm really saying to them is they're not being actually research rigorous, but also basically they have replicated a history of white supremacist historical methodology for 50 years.
Why do they cling so much to this white identity in the Middle Ages? Why does this have so much importance to them? Why are they holding on so tight to have this false narrative of a white Europe without any people of color in it?
It feeds into their vision of their future, right? Because what they're really wanting is this sort of utopic white nationalist, ethno-nationalist state. And so they're going back to the past to say, see, this is where it was happening for us, and we can celebrate all the things that were happening in that white Middle Ages. And no one will call us out because there weren't any of these other groups. We're using that as a kind of model for this kind of future, right, that they're really sort of pushing for. So they see the Middle Ages as one of the areas. They also go back to classics. So classics also has like a white supremacist problem.
So I want to shift gears here. We spent a lot of time talking about the alt-right, and they're trying to claim or whiteify the Middle Ages.
Yes.
Are there other types of historians that are writing and talking about the cross-cultural pollinization that was happening during that period, including yourself and others? Are there people out there writing another view of that period?
Yes, there are, actually. And I think I would immediately say that in a sort of Iberian studies, the work of Maria Menocal has really been the driving force there in discussing this kind of cultural nexus. I think that Michael Gomez's work on medieval Africa, which is a huge discussion about African medieval civilization, and basically very much along the exhibit of Rivers of Gold, thinking through that work. I think my colleagues who work on medieval Ethiopia, which was Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, and had a huge and very massive cultural production of various kinds of material culture, religious culture, literary, artistic culture. I think there is definitely work being done. I think there are other historians who are also thinking and talking about this, if that makes sense. Yes. But I think there's also, so there is a kind of push to forefront this work. I think the recent book by my colleague Geraldine Hang at the University of Texas, Austin, who just came out in March with The Invention of Race in the Middle Ages, is really going to sort of change the conversations in the field, because she's basically defining the frame out of discussing race in the Middle Ages in that book in a very wide way. She talks about everything from the Vinland Saga and this thinking through the indigenous point of view of the Vinland Saga in North America, to talking about the Crusades and the Mediterranean, to talking about actually the Roma and the sort of history of thinking about the Roma in the Middle Ages, to talking about, actually, she does a chapter also about England. It basically has a wide range, if that makes sense. Multiple areas across Europe, and thinking about multiple different groups and different configurations and things like that. I think that will be really important in the future and is already very important now in kind of reframing a lot of this discussion. So there is stuff coming out. I think the issue has been also the issue of that if we are academics in the ivory tower and we're only talking to each other, this does not help on the ground how to sort of shift this conversation in both popular culture, but also in sort of white supremacist, particularly digital spaces about this. That's become the other part of how to push back against this sort of frame of the white Middle Ages. It's like, how does this information then go out to the public so that they realize that there are resources and information that suggests that no, you know, this is inaccurate, this is not the case, etc.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about this segment at 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, Reclaiming History, is a way to get out to the general public all of the resources that are available about the wide variety of opinions and views of that period and other historical periods. And we here at 105.3 FM appreciate all of the time and effort and energy that you put into your work. And we appreciate that you're strong enough to handle all of the pushback, because we need you exactly where you are, writing and fighting, you know, as my grandmother would say, fighting the good fight. I want to say thank you for all of your hard work.
Oh, you're welcome.
Is there anything else we've missed or anything else you think my listeners need to hear about your work, about your future work, and what's going on with you next?
I think one of the things that I think would be interesting for your listeners to understand is that as we have had various histories of white supremacist visions of the Middle Ages, and we can even go back to sort of fairly recent American history, so the 19th century, the idea of manifest destiny and the Anglo-Saxon sort of, you know, utopic dream, which was absolutely linked to the Middle Ages with Jefferson onward. We also have communities who are pushing back. So my colleague Matthew Vernon's recent book, Race, Sort of Blackness and the Construction of the Middle Ages, he talks about various ways that 19th century African-Americans were pushing back on this. So you have, like, for instance, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a medieval romance called Dark Princess. There was Frederick Douglass actually talked about his name in relationship to kind of medieval Scottish world as a way to push back against the Anglo-Saxons. My colleague Cord Whitaker at Wellesley has been recently giving talks about how if you had in the antebellum South, the white slave owners basically getting together this form of ideas of medieval chivalry and would have these sort of like medieval tournaments and things like that. African-Americans were having tournaments in that period to push back against that. And I think that's the sort of new work that I'm really interested in, to think about what these communities in the 19th and 20th century have written or, you know, performed or done to push back against, have used the Middle Ages to push back against the white supremacist vision of the Middle Ages. And I think that actually has a nice kind of historical resonance in the sense that this is what I also see in contemporary spaces now, in digital spaces.
Dr. Kim, I can't believe it. We are out of time, but we've got to have you back on the show once again. To my listeners, make sure you tune in. Dr. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was part three of my conversation with Dr. Kim. She was she made me very excited, guys.
Yeah, I'm passionate. Very passionate. Passionate
talking about white supremacists taking over the Middle Ages. This is part three. We have many more continuations of my conversation with her. Tune in and check out our SoundCloud and website for future airings. Guy?
For those of y'all just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Livonia Mallory, and you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, airing on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Up next is the second installment of Peter Savio's discussion with Eleanor Stein, adjunct professor at Albany Law School. This segment provides us an overview of the extent of the recent policies and regulatory inactions and reversals at the federal level. Eleanor goes on to describe local and state responses to recent changes at the federal level and the significant work underway to help maintain the Paris Climate Agreement commitments.
Welcome to Climate Matters. We're here with Eleanor Stein, adjunct professor at Albany Law School and our guest today. In our last segment, we were discussing climate change science, some of the daunting issues we face as a society, as a people, and we began to talk about federal and state action and inaction. We went through some of the issues in terms of progress made under the Obama administration, and we just began to address some of the challenges that we're now failing to face or actually backing off from facing in terms of where the Trump administration is going. So welcome again. Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. So I spoke earlier about the Clean Power Plan, which was really the heart of the Obama approach to climate change. Although during his administrations, he also blocked new oil and gas exploration in the Arctic, made a climate deal with China, set the first regulations for coal ash, a harmful byproduct of coal mining, and set standards for automobile emissions, as well as the Clean Power Plan, which had to do with the generation of electricity, a key issue. So that whole panoply of actions was in the crosshairs for the Trump administration from the minute Trump took office. And I think his very first action had to do with rolling back the limits on coal ash and other waste products from coal mining. But so far, and we're only 2 years into it, Trump has done 112 actions to roll back climate regulation. 8 executive orders, 80 actions through administrative agencies, and 112 including actions by Congress. And these were either to delay the Obama-era regulations taking effect or to roll back rules that had already taken effect. And almost every one of these has been challenged in court. And this is where the role of the courts becomes very important. In many of these cases, people have been successful in challenging the rollback and at least slowing down the kind of juggernaut action of the Trump administration to basically free up coal mining, free up methane emissions, free up all of these the sources for greenhouse gases that we know have had these devastating impacts. So it's not only an ideology that climate change is a myth, it's also the very real nuts and bolts of putting more and more wealth in the pockets of the fossil fuel industry and essentially implementing a fossil fuel agenda. And that is the agenda that we're seeing. So this is a brutal assault on laws that have been passed and have been made, and on our the health and well-being of our country and the planet. But the most hopeful thing that's going on in response is not what's happening at the federal government, but to recast our thinking and look at what's going on at the state level and at the city level and even at the community level. Mm-hmm. And this is where we really have hope for the future.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we recently had a guest who is developing something called the Hope Solar Farm, community solar, an opportunity available to people. But some of the hope that we want to talk about here today is tapping into your expertise, and that is, so in terms of actions you're describing at the state and local level, what examples would you share with us to that help actually put some effort and propulsion behind that hope?
Okay. You know, Emory Lovins calls it applied hope. Yep. That's his description of his form of optimism. He runs the Rocky Mountain Institute, one of probably the longest standing organizations for furthering energy efficiency and renewable energy. So, you know, June 2017, Trump announces that he's pulling the United States out of the Paris Accord. The next day, New York, California, and I think 13 other states announced the formation of what they call the U.S. Climate Alliance. And they've been joined by other states since then. And these are states that pledged that they themselves would take up the burden of the Paris Accord, and that within these states, they would continue policies aggressively to meet and even exceed the goals of the Paris Agreement. And so they have made great strides in the last 2 years.
And those strides that many states have made are quite impressive. We'll get into that in just a moment. Just to remind listeners, you're listening to Climate Matters. Our guest today is Eleanor Stein. So some of the steps being taken at the state level, can you provide an indication, some examples of that?
Sure. Let me start right here at home in New York.
Please.
So Governor Cuomo actually just announced an increase in the ambition of our plan to increase the amount of renewable energy that we build and produce in New York State. So the current state target, I believe, is a 70% of our electric generation should be from renewable resources like solar power and wind power by the year 2030, which is a very tough target to meet, but the state is mobilizing to meet that target as fast as possible. That means building solar farms, as they're called, or wind farms, really hundreds of them, large and small. Your rooftop is part of this effort. And the importance of centering on the production of electricity is that there is a path, it's called the deep decarbonization pathway, for this country and many other countries to actually attain carbon neutrality or zero carbon or close to it by the middle of this century, which is the climate scientists and thought leaders' view of the minimum that's necessary for us to do to combat the pace of climate change. You know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the global science body, it tells us that we have 10 to 12 years to make profound changes in how we get electricity and how we do transportation and many other parts of our society in order to prevent irreversible changes in things like the melting of the Greenland ice sheet.
So the central focus on the power sector and the provision of clean electricity, decarbonizing the electric grid, I think most of us could follow that. What are the connections? How do we stitch together how we broaden that decarbonization to other sectors of the economy?
So the what's called the deep decarbonization pathway for us begins with decarbonizing electricity, which is, oddly enough, relatively easy. We know how to do it. There's no technological obstacle. And in fact, those resources are now cheaper than most fossil fuel resources. So we have the economics on our side. But as that process gets underway, we can begin to power other parts of our economy with electricity. So let's electrify transportation. Let's have electric cars. Let's have electric buses. Let's have more public transportation and not just rely on individual cars. But electricity, if it's decarbonized, presents us with an opportunity to make those changes in transportation and similar changes in home heating, in cooking, in industrial processes that now use oil or other fuels, gasoline, other fuels that are fossil fuels, can be powered with electricity. And that's our vision.
Mm. So these steps in terms of decarbonizing the grid and broadening that, in terms of the deep decarbonization, does that occur in a sequence, or is there some parallel track, or what is the vision?
The vision is that, as with any crisis, we have to do everything all at once.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, we've already begun decarbonizing electricity. And, New York State has probably about 26% of its electricity now is generated from renewable resources. Most of that, almost all of that, comes from big hydropower dams up on the Canadian border. But many other states are far more advanced in their solar and wind. California, Massachusetts, Hawaii, certainly far ahead of us. And the rest of the world, many other countries are far ahead. But as we increase the amount of reliance on sources like wind and solar, in order to do that, we need to be able to use those resources, that electricity, when it's produced. So the more applications we have for, let's say, solar-powered electricity at the time that it's produced, the more successful we will be in decarbonizing the society and keeping that moving.
Great. Well, thank you, Eleanor. We've been discussing deep decarbonization as an avenue and a vision to getting us to a future where the environment and our children and grandchildren's future is protected, a stronger economy as well. Thank you very much, Eleanor.
That was Peter Savio with Eleanor Stein, adjunct professor at Albany Law School, talking federal changes, regulation, and regulations under the Obama administration to the Trump administration and the rollback of climate change gains. Next up, the Spirit of the Suffragettes Summer Concert Series and Community Resource Fair will be launching alongside the 7th Annual Freedom Festival on Saturday, June 8th from 3 to 6 p.m., and they'll be held in Freedom Square every Tuesday at 4 to 7 p.m. from July 16th through August 20th, closing with the 9th Annual Story Harvest Celebration in early September. For more information, visit mediasanctuary.org. Up next is Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Cassidy McKay with an introduction to present-day activists and organizations in anticipation for the summer festival Spirit of the Suffragettes. Today, Cassidy McCabe speaks with Mary Gavazzi, the president of the Troy Library Board, about grassroots organizations and individual activist experts' efforts in the community.
My name is Cassidy McCabe, and today I'm here with Marie Gavazzi, the president of the Library Board in Troy. In anticipation for the Spirit of the Suffragette Festival, we'll be looking at how the history of women's suffrage has impacted the present day and what sorts of social justice work can be done to move forward. Marie, would you be able to share what work you do?
Well, I personally, to earn a living, do computer support for medical record software. And then on top of that, one of the advantages of only working 3 days a week, I also am able to do a number of different community activities. I feel a strong interest in preservation, in neighborhood activities, in civic engagement, and libraries. And try to be active in all of those areas.
Is there anything happening right now that pertains to the work you do, like any current events?
Well, election season is about to start, especially for our local offices. And on behalf of TNAC, Troy Neighborhoods Action Council, we always organize a Meet the Candidates night for our local elections, and we'll be doing so again this fall. So that's one thing that's coming up. But with springtime, there are always a lot of activities starting up. So we're in the midst of planning the Hidden Garden Tour. It'll be the 20th anniversary of that. Getting ready to do plantings in downtown Troy Planters. There are always plenty of things to do. One of the things that surprised me when I first came to become active in more than just my work, was how welcomed I was around Troy. I expected to be pushed away and told, oh, we're fine the way we are. But I was welcomed. Everybody wanted me. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that everybody finds the same thing today.
Mm-hmm. You said the Hidden Garden Tour. Is there dates for that? Like, when is that happening?
It's the Thursday before Memorial Day.
Okay. Is there any historical figure that you can think of that inspires your work or introduced you to some of the stuff you do?
I would say that it's more local figures.
Mm-hmm.
Like Claire Davis started Troy and Bloom, the planting of the concrete planters all over the city, mm-hmm. 25 years ago. And that purely voluntary effort has continued. And the people who started the sanctuary, however mm-hmm. long ago was started. And just all the individuals who do something.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like a division of labor.
Yeah.
And they're my inspiration.
Yeah. Activists, I find some of the best work is the grassroots work that kind of just builds community. It's great. In what ways would you say that our social rights movements have changed in relation to the past century?
I don't know that I have an answer for that.
Okay.
Last year, I think, may have been an anniversary of a variety of things that happened in the 60s, the 50th mm-hmm. anniversary. So there were a lot of books that were out
mm-hmm.
last year that described the environment that existed back then. And even though I lived through that,
mm-hmm.
I was shocked by how different things were then than they mm-hmm. are now. You kind of forget.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Would you consider yourself an activist?
No, I don't consider myself an activist.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself as active
mm-hmm.
and doing things, and I have certain principles that guide my behavior.
Mm.
I stand up for things, even though I think I may lose, because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, I see every interaction as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Steve and I were at an event the other day, and he introduced me to somebody from the Albany Library Foundation who has paid for magazines for the Troy Library.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an opportunity to get to meet that person.
Yeah. You just said that there's some things you stand up for. What would you mind sharing? What kind of stuff you stand up for?
There was a design for a building in downtown Troy that had an office building on one end of the block, a residential building on the other end of the block, and a parking garage in the middle. I felt that was a really old-fashioned design. And totally inappropriate for what I wanted to see in my downtown. Mm-hmm. And I didn't expect that anyone would pay attention to me. But at every opportunity that they were presenting, I went and spoke out against that design.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other people who also spoke. And then the next thing I knew, they had changed the design.
Mm-hmm.
And they had eliminated the parking garage on the street. And also reduce the number of parking spaces.
Mm-hmm.
They had decided that they could do with fewer parking spaces because the office building and the residential building would use the parking spaces at different times of the day. And I thought that was real progress in terms of the future, where I don't expect that we'll need as many parking spaces. So that's an example where I actually achieved something, even though I didn't anticipate that I would be able to.
That reminded me, I remember in high school I was in student government, and our school received a huge grant to increase STEM research, like technology, we were getting a facility to learn how to build cars, which is really cool, but they were going to destroy all the art stuff and all the music stuff. They were going to get rid of the theater for our drama club, our concerts. They were going to get rid of it, and they had no plan as to where that was going to go. And I just was the one person who raised me and was like, we have like a huge auditorium and music program in the wings where you're planning on putting all that STEM stuff. Where is that going? And they didn't have an answer. And so then they pulled back and then they actually made a plan. And now my little sister's at that school and they've actually expanded their music theater and they've moved where the STEM stuff is going. So, yeah.
Well, I find it interesting that at your age, mm-hmm. and you said you're a senior at SUNY Albany, that you've already achieved that. Mm-hmm. Just think how many other opportunities that you'll avail yourself of to accomplish things.
Yeah. Thank you. If you were to nominate someone for a modern suffragette, could you think of someone you would nominate and why?
Emily Men. She's a member of the League of Women Voters and represents them at the farmers market, other events. And she dresses up in clothing that was what was apropos at that time. Mm-hmm. And she's a very striking figure.
I think we have her as a picture for the Spirit of the Suffragettes Festival. We have it on our webpage.
I wouldn't be surprised if you noticed her.
Thank you for your time, Marie. And for more information about this upcoming Women's Resource Fair and Summer Festival, please visit tinyurl.com/suffragettespirit. And to be sure to save the dates for our Summer Festival, we're launching with a 7th Annual Freedom Festival on Saturday, June 8th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. with featured artist, jazz legend Faye Victor and the Mutations. The festival and resource fair will then continue every Tuesday, 4 to 7 p.m. from July 16th through August 20th. And close with the 9th Annual Story Harvest Celebration in September. Thank you for listening to this week's piece on the Spirit of the Suffragettes.
That was Cassidy McCabe speaking with Maria Gavazzi, the president of the Troy Library Board, about grassroots organizations and individual activist efforts in the community.
In our next segment, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with activist and singer-songwriter Taina Asili about her new album, Resilience.
I'm joined here in the studio by Taina Asili. She has a new record coming out. Taina, tell us all about it.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for having me. This new album has been a long labor of love. I've been working on it for about the past 5 years. And it actually started right here in Troy with a residency at the Art Center of the Capital Region. The album is called Resiliencia. And for the album, I interviewed women of color from my community about their stories of resilience, and then compose songs based on their stories. So the album is kind of biographical in nature and, you know, still pulling from that Afro-Latin reggae rock fusion music that I do, but with the content really centering around the wisdom that I received and gathered from these women's stories and where those stories intersect with my own story.
Is the album mostly in Spanish?
The album is 50% in Spanish and 50% in English. And some songs are, you know, a combination of both.
And what sort of stories do you tell?
Well, you know, when I say my community, I mean that in a really broad sense. So I did interview people right here from Albany and Troy in the Capital Region. And some of those people are women who shared stories of surviving sexual assault, surviving breast cancer, becoming, you know, coming into their own as a trans woman, stories about loving one's body, about coming across the border and, you know, surviving that experience, you know, working to, you know, come into their own power as an artist. So there's a lot of different stories in there.
And how do you go about translating someone else's story into your own song?
Well, that was the labor of love. That's what really took quite a long time. What I did was I filmed interviews with the women that I interviewed, and I took those interviews and took notes from them. So I would sit with those interviews and I'd watch them in detail and take notes. And some of that looked like writing words down, phrases. And from those notes, I really tried to think about, you know, you're an editor, so you understand what this is like, really trying to put together what is the story, you know, what is the arc that's happening here. So I did that. And also with the in mind thinking about how does this story relate to my own story? You know, where's my voice in this? So, for example, I have never had cancer. But this, the deeper message in this particular story, this was a story by Jackie Williams, an elder Black woman from our community. Her story was really about starting out as somebody who really was coming into her power as an independent woman, not needing to rely on people and finding strength in that. And then moving through this illness and realizing that she needed to and found power in love, in leaning into community and being supported by community. And I certainly relate to some of that experience of needing to trust and lean into community. For example, when my parents died, when my father died of cancer, or when my mother passed away. And so there was definitely times in my life where I had to really trust and lean into community and be vulnerable in a way that I had never been vulnerable before. And so, you know, I related to this story on this level.
Wow, that sounds like a very deep record. Do you think that when people listen to it, they feel that continuity of the process, or is each song kind of a different texture, a different approach? Some of them are first person, some third person. Is there anything that ties all those stories together?
Well, I would say that some of the songs are not specifically about one particular story, but maybe teachings that I gathered from several different stories that I, you know, kind of pulled into its own song. And then musically, what I did was, you know, people often ask me, what's your genre? Like, what style of music do you play? And that's always the hardest thing for me to answer and the hardest, I think the most difficult piece about marketing myself as an artist, quite frankly. But what is most important to me is that my music is authentic to the story that I'm trying to tell. So I'm listening to the spirit of the song rather than caring about what genre, if it's rock or hip hop or salsa or what have you. So, you know, what I often do is, you know, once I sit with the story, you know, I try to really listen to what type of music is going to hold the story, you know, and sometimes that means I actually write several different musical compositions for a story and then try to figure out which one fits best.
We're speaking with Taina Asili. Her new record, Resilience, or Resiliencia, is just out. For folks who want to hear the music rather than hear about it, where can they go?
Well, right now we have a pre-release on Bandcamp. So you can go to my Taina Asili. You can find me on Bandcamp, and you can pre-order the album. And when you pre-order the album right now, you will get the first two songs, the two singles that we've released, which are Plant the Seed and Resiliencia, the title track of the album. And once the album releases, you'll get the full album. The album releases officially on April 19th. And then from that point, you can get it in all of the usual ways, iTunes and streaming services. But if you really want to support the artist, where the money is going to go directly into the pocket, to continue that work forward, definitely Bandcamp would be the way to support.
Now, you've had quite a trajectory as a performing artist. I know of you first as a punk rock singer on the West Coast. I don't know if you did other stuff even before that, but tell us in a nutshell, you know, the path that you followed.
Yes, the path that I followed has not been a straight line, and that's for sure. You know, just in a nutshell, I grew up in a family that played Afro-Latin music and jazz and doo-wop, actually. So my first singing was actually doo-wop with my father, who was a doo-wop singer. And then I started to train in opera. So at the age of 14, I started training in opera, and I did that until I was in college. And then simultaneously, at the age of 16, as you said, I was in a punk band. And so I was touring around the nation for 8 years with a band called Antiproduct. And that was where I started to move into my social justice music and started to become a social justice songwriter, you know, really coming into my own in terms of my activism and my songwriting. And since then, I've done spoken word performances. There was a time period in my life where I was really focused on spoken word when I lived in Philadelphia, particularly. And then when I moved here to the Capital Region, it was around 2006 that I started doing what I do now, which is a fusion of all of those different things, the punk rock rebellion and all of the different training I've done, which is now also included flamenco. So I went and lived in Spain and studied at a flamenco conservatory studying flamenco singing. So all of those different influences inform the music that I do.
So you've really, matured as an artist just as the recording industry has imploded as a business. How do those two trajectories work out for you? I know everybody's struggling for it in the creative industries.
Well, I would say that the biggest blessing that I received is that my start was in punk rock. And punk rock has this DIY, this do-it-yourself ethic that was very strong in the scene that I was in. So, you know, we did everything ourselves. We screen printed our own shirts. We screen printed the covers of our records. You know, we booked our own shows. We booked our own tours. And we were able to distribute records and perform, you know, all over the world and perform nationally many, many times. And so I had that really as like a, you know, a muscle that I had built over the years. And so when I started to do this particular work, as you said, you know, what I'm doing today is a challenge on in the sense that the record industry is not what it used to be, but also that I'm a social justice artist. So it's very controversial music sometimes that I'm performing, like when I am performing No Es Mi Presidente, Not My President, you know, one of my hit songs, you know, that's a controversial piece. And sometimes people are afraid to touch that. You know, musically, my genre is, you know, it's not easily fitting in a box. And so sometimes that can be a challenge for people to wrap their heads around. But I would say that the plus side has been that music is leaning more into that independent artist realm in a way that it never has before. And, you know, I'm able to self-publish. I'm able to easily use social media and, you know, many different types of platforms to get my music out there myself. And so because I've had that muscle that I've created over the years, I, you know, do the best that I can to get my music out as far and wide as possible. And I would say that, you know, so far so good. You know, like I'm a full-time artist. I make a living full-time from my music. And, you know, I feel really, really blessed with how far I've come thus far.
So you've told us how to find the music. Where's your website? How can people find out more about you?
You can go to tainaasili.com, and I'll spell that because it's a little challenging. It's TAINAASILI.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for stopping by. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Taina Asila speaking about her career with her new album, Resilience. Hey, Guy, guess what?
Oh, no.
That concludes the show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I am Livonia Mallory.
And I am Guy Schaefer. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.
And we'll be closing out the show with the title track of Taina Asili's album, Resiliencia. La lluvia cae, el río nos guía, la lluvia cae.